This is Nullius in Verba, a podcast about science.
What it is, and what it could be. It's co-hosted by me, Smriti Mehta from UC Berkeley.
And me, Daniel Lagens from Eindhoven University of Technology.
In today's episode, we discuss the role of criticism in science. When is criticism constructive as opposed to obsessive? What are the features of fair and useful scientific criticism? Should we explicitly teach junior researchers to both give and accept criticism? And should we organize 8-hour discussions with scientists who are critical of each other's work for a conference of critical criticism? Enjoy.
Perhaps it would be better for science that all criticism should be avowed. It would certainly have the effect of rendering it more matured and less severe. But, on the other hand, it would have the evil of frequently repressing it altogether. Because there exists amongst the lower ranks of science a genus irritabile, who are disposed to argue that every criticism is personal. It is clearly the interest of all who fear inquiries to push this principle as far as possible, whilst those whose sole object is truth can have no apprehensions from the severest scrutiny.
Nice. Who is that by?
This is Charles Babbage, 1830.
Nice.
Talked about his book, I think, before.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He has this book on the decline of science in England, mm-hmm. And on some of its causes. It's a very interesting book. Mm-hmm. One of the first, I would say, maybe meta-scientific works pointing out things are not going well.
Yeah.
But this is one of his other aspects and that he discusses, criticism, the role mm-hmm. of criticism, which is our topic of today.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about criticism in science.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like another part of his book about criticism, and that would maybe bring us into a first type of criticism people can give, namely if it's okay to criticize people versus the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So I'll give you Babbage's idea about this. He writes, "I feel as strongly as anyone, not merely the impropriety, but the injustice of introducing private character into such discussions. There is, however, a maxim too well established to need any comment of mine. The public character of every public servant is legitimate subject of discussion, and his fitness or unfitness for office may be fairly canvassed by any person. Those whose too sensitive feelings shrink from such an ordeal have no right to accept the emoluments of office, for they know that it is the condition to which all must submit who are paid from the public purse." And this is in his criticism on people who are, for example, members of the Royal Society.
Yeah.
He criticizes mm-hmm. a little bit of, you know, academic societies. But I think we are public servants.
Yeah. I
so
agree.
Do you think it's okay if you think that I'm basically too incompetent to be a scientist and I should just move over? Do you think it's okay to say this?
Well, yes.
All right. Well, that's the end of the podcast.
That's
then.
Done.
Bye, Smriti.
Well,
then we're done.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the gray area, right? But you can say, I mean, ad hominem attacks are obviously not legitimate and you really shouldn't be attacking people specifically. But insofar as we're doing work that's important, that has consequences, we do want to make sure that the people doing it are competent enough. So I think as long as, and, you know, there's ways to do it where you focus on, you know, the methodology or, you know, mentioned that there's, you know, the people don't have enough background knowledge or don't have the necessary methodological or technical skills to do the work that they want to do. And I think that's, you know, as long as you're not doing it in a mean-spirited way, I think it's fine.
As long as you just kindly say that people don't have the skills to do good scientific work, then it's all fine. With
well,
kindness
you can
in
do,
your heart.
Yeah, well...
yeah.
So this brings me to a question I had. I mean, criticism itself is just it sounds like such a negative word, right? Mm-hmm. And we sometimes differentiate it from feedback, right? Like criticism versus sort of constructive feedback. So you can, right? I'm not saying that you have to sugarcoat things, but you can state things, right? Not saying you're not competent enough, but it's like, oh, here are some skills that you may be, well, not lacking. That sounds bad
here's
too.
Some feedback about some skills that you might
want
learn
to build.
And also,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And also some alternative career paths you might want to consider because then you're happier. Yeah. No, that sounds much better.
Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah.
This is great advice. Yeah. I'm just giving you feedback. This is not criticism.
But it's, I mean, what's the term that Babbage uses? The Latin term, the irritable species?
Genus irritabile.
Yeah, people are, what do you think? I mean, you're Dutch, so I think you guys are a different species altogether. when it comes to, you know, being blunt and maybe being able to take it. At least, I mean, in the American context, there is just this... at least what I see is a real strong push to never like not hurt feelings and any kind of criticism or even I think feedback. Like you have to be really careful and sensitive. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be sensitive, but I think it goes a little too far where even sort of legitimate what's meant to be constructive criticism is taken not that well, which I don't think is healthy.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting, I guess also the reason that we wanted to discuss this.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, we know that criticism plays a really important role in science.
Yeah.
So to the extent that scientists don't criticize each other,
mm-hmm.
then it really is getting into the way of what some people at least consider a healthy science, because a healthy science requires quite some internal criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And we might come back to it. I mean, and there's a couple of people who explicitly say this or make this a very central core of what it means to do science. So in that sense, the less criticism you get mm-hmm. and the more careful people are about expressing criticism, you could really say it comes... at the cost of doing the best possible science we can do. Do you think that's the case sometimes? Do you have the feeling?
Definitely. I think that's definitely the case. But I think you're also right to point out that it's not something that's taught. And how do I mean, there's criticism and then there's scientific criticism. And I think mm-hmm. those are different, right? I mean, you have now... So John Ioannidis has a paper with Vinay Prasad in the European Journal of Clinical Investigation, and it's called mm-hmm. Constructive okay. and Obsessive Criticism in Science. And so I think now we're in a time where they make the case that obsessive criticism tends to focus on either a handful of individuals and their work, often includes ad hominem aspects, and critics often lack field-specific skills and technical expertise. So this idea that now you could have people on Twitter that are just criticizing your work without the relevant expertise. And I think to really do scientific criticism well, you need to both have the technical skills. And in some way, you also need to be able to lay out somebody's theory or their evidence, right? Like you have to have enough mm-hmm. knowledge of what they have done to be able to criticize it well. And I think once that's done, it's like Lakatos says, right? Like, good criticism is always constructive, right? So it should lead us to just a better understanding of what's going on or move us forward in some way, right? Sort of be a generative process.
Yeah. Criticism shouldn't just be there to tear things
yes.
down.
Yeah.
Maybe unless there's really no way to salvage it, that's something. But then at least let's say in the process of criticizing, the constructive part is that everybody has learned something about why there was a mistake, for example. I feel that is sometimes. People often think criticism is always negative, even if at the end your goal is just to say, this just shouldn't exist, for example.
Yeah.
But if you give very good reasons why something shouldn't exist, sometimes people can actually learn something about it and be like, oh yeah, okay, I see what the issue is. So sometimes, yeah, even the harshest criticism can have this constructive component, I guess, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I hadn't heard about this obsessive criticism kind of thing, but it's a very interesting one because it happens.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely see people become slightly obsessed with people.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not John Ioannidis, who I think has become the focus of many, many people for a lot of reasons, like during the pandemic, for example, as a point of criticism. But I do notice sometimes that people pick you out sort of as a person to criticize because they disagree with you. And especially social media makes it very easy to disagree with people because everything is such a, you know, fragment, basically. You can't really have a real discussion, I think. So it's easy to have some sort of statement that you want to criticize.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you have people who just, I don't know, do this all the time.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because there's a point where you have to say, okay, this is getting a little bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in the most extreme case, when it doesn't stop, I will actually block some people.
Oh, okay.
And it's interesting because in a way, in science, we want to have criticism, right? And I definitely want to have criticism. But there's also a certain limit. Just as another anecdote today, I was tagged on Twitter by somebody about a completely unrelated topic. This person just wanted to point out some sort of ethical complaint. So they filed an ethical complaint against another scientist. It had absolutely nothing to do with my tweet. They just wanted to bring it to my attention.
Oh, interesting.
And then I did click on it and I'm like, what is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw that this person basically has been obsessively filing complaints about a person. And then even the independent ethical board in the Netherlands. So this is a sort of national
IRB.
Ethical research.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not an IRB. It's really there to resolve suspicions of ethical violations.
Mm-hmm.
After a university has dealt with it, you can go to an independent committee. It's called the LOWI in the Netherlands.
Huh.
Yeah, it's already very good that we have it because I think many countries don't even have this.
Yeah, right.
So if you get stuck at your university, you want to complain, you want to criticize somebody, but in the, you know, really about
ethical
maybe something.
Issues. And,
ethical issues. You can go there. But even this committee had said, okay, we have listened to you again and again, and we've asked you to explain it again and again, and it's just not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We're giving you one last deadline to sort of summarize your complaints.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, we will stop responding.
Yeah.
And this sounded to me, I didn't dig into it more than like a couple of minutes, but it sounded to me like obsessive criticism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you get too far. So it's interesting that, we want criticism. We don't want it too little. You were complaining about that sometimes you thought there's not enough criticism. There's also an upper bound. So it has to be somewhere healthy in the middle, I guess.
Yeah. So Prasad and Ioannidis do give some criteria for what counts as obsessive criticism. And I think it's useful to. And I mentioned some of them. So they talk about focus and behavior. The first one is interesting in focus. There's three for focus. One is, you know, focusing on one or a handful of individuals and their work, as opposed to a collection of scientific papers that all point in the same direction. And this is kind of interesting. I've seen this happen in sort of one of my areas of research, which is growth mindset. And I think Harold Dweck just gets a lot of attacks. And there are certain groups of researchers who have really published a bunch of papers in the past like 5-6 years, specifically targeting her work and mentioning. And I always, I don't know what do you think about that? Because to me, it's on one hand, if you really want to challenge. I mean, and in psychology, we have this problem of, you know, the toothbrush issue, right? Where people have their own toothbrushes. And so insofar as you're attacking a specific toothbrush, it's hard not for it to be targeted with, to feel like it's targeted toward the person whose toothbrush it is. On the other hand,
it becomes very personal quickly.
It becomes very personal. On the other hand, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's ways to do it because it's not like she's the only one publishes on this, right? There's like so much work out there. And I feel like you could do it in a way that doesn't feel so personal.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation because I recognize it. I think this happens a lot.
Yeah.
You also had this during the replication crisis.
Yeah.
Certain people got way more attention than other people and not really for any objectively justifiable reason, just sort of luck or bad luck, I guess, for the people, you know, randomness.
Yeah.
It is in part, I feel, a consequence of the way that we also don't distribute the benefits you get from getting well known. So there are really like too much prestige benefits awarded to single individuals when it is a whole body of work.
Right.
And the opposite side is, yeah, that if people start to criticize it, then these same people also get all of the criticism.
They're just more salient, yeah.
Yeah, in both ways. So they got the benefit, but then they also get the downside. So the whole system, I feel, is not very healthy, but that's the way it works now.
Yeah.
So that was the first one.
That was the first one.
Focus on single person instead of a group of people.
Mm-hmm. Right. The second one is tinged with ad hominem, so that we talked about. So comments about the person who's authoring, including the nature of their job, past work, and past collaborations. And there, I think it's important to make this distinction, right? So it's one thing if you're talking about the way somebody has done a particular analysis, for example, that is perhaps valid. But if you start saying, oh, this person has a PhD from, you know, University of Nowhere, right? Like when it gets sort of irrelevant to the question of the work that we're immediately addressing, but you're sort of making attacks that are sort of personal, then I think it's probably a problem.
This is an interesting category, though. So I also read a little bit about this. There's a nice paper by Alex Holcomb called Ad Hominem Rhetoric in Scientific Psychology.
Yeah.
And he also actually, he says something that's interesting somewhere. He writes that it's very nice that we have social media because now we have just unfiltered access to the ad hominems that scientists make. But beforehand, it always went through an editor, and an editor would say, are you sure you want to make this comment? Probably not. You want to remove it. But now we just see what scientists say and think and do, or they publish blogs without any...
That's good how?
No, that's good because now we can see them make these ad hominems. So we really have data, basically, to see, so what is it when people, you know, otherwise you just think it, but now they actually say it. And but I think he has a sort of nice point that it's, seen as very incorrect.
Making anything, ad hominem attacks, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, anything that you sort of that points towards the person is basically not allowed anymore. But it's not so easy to distinguish things between people, and sometimes you might be like, yeah, this is an aspect of a person now. From his paper, I learned that one of the founding members, I think, of the Royal Society, which, you know, with our Nullius in Verba theme, is always good to refer to.
Yeah.
So this was Robert Boyle. Mm-hmm. He proposed explicit rules of etiquette for scientific controversies. Mm-hmm. And one was disputes should be about findings and not about persons.
Yeah.
And I think this is really what most people will say and also subscribe to. But I'm not really sure when a dispute is about a person and not their findings. As you already said, sometimes their theory is basically the person, so they'll take it personally.
Yeah.
But sometimes you just have to say, you have been making really low quality arguments for 5 years now, and I think we should just stop listening to you as a field because it's enough. Am I wrong?
Well...
Is this my Dutch nature coming through here? You know, is this the too much the Dutch directness?
I mean, I guess, sort of loath to mention tone here, but I think it does depend, right? It depends on how you say it, right?
I have some feedback for you. You should increase the quality of your work.
Well, or you know, it's not so much that if you say something like, oh, you're just stupid, stop talking, it's different from saying, hey, you have, you know, made these points here. This is why these points are wrong, right? There's ways to go about it that just feel less personal if you can point to specific instances of where the theory was wrong or why it's wrong and how it's been repeatedly wrong. So I think there's...
Sort of like this Lowy was doing to this one person where they said, look, we followed our procedure. Yeah. We gave you time to reply. Right. But again and again, we've pointed this out and now it's enough.
Right.
It's nice. I was also listening, sorry to go on about this, but I was listening to the autobiography of Daniel Dennett. A colleague of mine recommended it. And it's actually quite nice. Yeah. Very nice. Listen to the audiobook. But
does he read
very
it?
Very recommended. Yeah.
No.
No, he doesn't read. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. But it's relatively recent, I think very recent, and there are a lot of nice anecdotes. It's just a collection of very nice anecdotes, but he also discusses some of his academic fights, basically. And then on the one hand, in the book, he'll say, look, criticism is essential. It's really important. But he'll also admit that there are certain people who just didn't want to give in. Mm-hmm. They just kept saying the same thing and not engaging with his arguments. Mm. So, you know, people would say, yeah, but this and this and this. And then he would say, but remember, 10 years ago, I wrote this paper where I point out why this is not right. And they just didn't engage. And then he also says, sometimes you just have to disengage from their criticism. So it's, again, this double-sided thing. But I think he's quite negative about some people, really. He'll just point out, like, these people had some sort of obsession or some sort of mental flaw. He'll put, you know, people sort of in a position of, yeah, the work they did wasn't good because of who they are or because of how they were as a person. Huh. Yeah. So the criticism is not just their arguments, but he'll say, look, they will just doggedly not give in or something, you know? And he'll criticize people for this.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that raises a few things for me. One is, for criticism to work well in science, both parties have to engage in the process in good faith, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I think that is probably super important. Unless you trust that the other person is doing it, again, for the advancement of science or for good reasons, and you're not just being personally attacked. So that becomes very mm-hmm. important. And the second thing is, and maybe because he's a philosopher, right? And I think there you were just, yeah, that's interesting, right? Because if you're doing empirical work, then you can focus on that in a way where if you're just sitting in your armchair philosophizing, right? Yeah. There's just more room for interpersonal or like personal styles of thinking to permeate all of the work that you do. And I'm that's an interesting question. Like, is it more valid to criticize just the way people think and make arguments or the way they engage with arguments? Is that more valid to do it in something like a discipline like philosophy?
It's an interesting point. I think you're right. Because, I mean, at least we can say, look, I'm just talking about the data. Something.
Right.
But there, you really talk about logical arguments or...
Right. Or I can even like, you know, give you my data. It's like, okay, if you think, right, like here it is, like this is what you can analyze a different way and we can have, you know, talk about interpretive criticism, right? Maybe I'm but you can't do that in philosophy, right?
But I have to say that the moments that I get most annoyed by people, you know, when I really think, okay, is not about the data, but it's about their interpretation of the data. When the data's there and they will just I think explicitly not admit that there's a problem somewhere, for example. And you're just like, but couldn't you just say this honestly for a moment instead of, I know that, you know, it might be that they spend their entire career on something and then research points out, well, this is really not the way it is. Mm-hmm. Sorry. But people will just keep digging in, sort of.
Yeah.
If you take them seriously, then they have some sort of problem with rationally updating based on evidence. Hmm. If you don't take them honestly, then you think that they are playing a game and they're not taking evidence seriously, but they're just trying to defend their own work. So, yeah, and I think both of those are actually not very positive, you know, about people, and they're about people. So it's about what they do. It's not, it's not how they ran a statistical analysis, but it's really like
the way
what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you think that's part of, that is something that should be maybe part of the curriculum, like almost as like the way we teach statistical or methodological tools, of having these sort of cognitive tools that we explicitly talk about, where it's like, hey, you should really be trying to, you know, actively work against these instincts to not, or like look at evidence a certain way, or I'm not sure about what would go in it, but sort of, you know, sort of cognitive tools that you should employ when you're engaged in scientific criticism or scientific work, versus it's just sort of a personality thing that you really can't control and maybe just have to filter.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because you're basically saying the way that we should write about science or how we interpret data should be a little bit more formal. And the way that we disagree about what data does should be a bit more formal.
Yeah.
And I agree, because I don't think that part, I don't know, where are you supposed to learn this? Like, it sounds like something that people should learn in a debate club or something, you know? I have the feeling, I don't know what goes on in a debate club. I've never been a member, but it feels like they probably learn some quite formal mechanisms for clearly restating the point of the other side. And then, I don't know, making an argument and doing it in a more formal way than we do in science. It might be good.
Yeah. Or even logic, right? I mean, the first thing, mm-hmm. one of the first things you learn in logic are just cognitive, like logical fallacies. And we mentioned, yeah. right, things like arguments from authority, like you shouldn't make those, yeah. right? Ad hominem attacks, you shouldn't make those. Even straw manning, right? You shouldn't do that. That's bad. And you see that a lot, right? People trying to criticize other people's theory, and you realize when you read it, if you know something about it, oh, you don't understand this well enough, yeah. to criticize it, and you're just trying to, and it's a matter of, yeah, maybe just explicitly discussing these sort, mm-hmm. of, you know, how to make logical arguments, how to analyze arguments, and doing that, mm-hmm. more formally yeah. than we typically do, and teaching people even the vocabulary of how to talk about these things and what not to do. And yeah, you know, scientific integrity, like you, that is part of that, right? Maintaining, because it is so, mm-hmm. I'm sure you've experienced this, right? I'm sure everybody has of this. Sometimes you can, like, it can be so hard when you're engaged in an argument to not take shortcuts, even though you know you can, right? Right? Like, yeah. or yeah. focus on the, mm-hmm. one part of somebody's argument that you know is just totally untenable. Instead, yeah. of being charitable. But that is also something, mm-hmm. you learn in, right? Like the principle of charitable interpretation, right? If you're attacking somebody's argument, you should try to attack the best possible version of it. What people, mm-hmm. now call, mm-hmm. like steel manning, but, mm-hmm. things like that, right? Where you're really trying to, yeah. hold yourself to a certain standard of engaging, even if the other side is not going to be as charitable. And it's hard to do, right? When you're just, yeah. trying to win an argument, but that's a problem, right?
But it sounds like fun, actually. It sounds like a fun hands-on course to do, yeah. this. And I remember that you once recommended a textbook. I think it's a statistics textbook by Philip Stark.
Mm-hmm. Is that his name? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. An online textbook, yeah, is just about logic, yeah.
So I guess he also recognized, like, hey, we're not teaching this anywhere else in the curriculum, yeah. but it's quite important,
yeah.
If you want to discuss evidence, so let's do it. Now, we were at the second point of your paper. Was there a third one, just to round it up?
Well, so this is just on focus. So criteria for obsessive criticism. Okay. And the third one in terms of focus was just a lack of track record of field-specific skills.
This is by the critics.
They lack the expertise to... But then they go into behavior. So many of them are very social media related. Mm-hmm, things like repetitive and persistent comments, including C-lining. Have you heard that term, C-lining?
I've seen it come by. I've never looked up what it's supposed to mean.
They define it as a technique of trolling or harassment where the critic claims to be sincere and civil, but relentlessly and repeatedly asks for evidence and for answers to questions that have already previously been answered.
Yeah, this is a bit what Dennett also complained, yeah. about, that, right. this philosopher would just ignore the paper they wrote 10 years ago and keep at it, basically. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lengthy commentaries, Twitter threads, rapid responses, sometimes longer than the original work. Third, strong, okay. degree of moralizing, which I thought was kind of interesting. And you see that a lot in certain subdisciplines now, claiming that the work will lead to evil or wrong policy choices.
Some of these don't sound so bad, though, moralizing. But I think a lot of criticism, the moment that people get upset about something enough so that they will go out and criticize you, is because they care about it, because they actually think there's real harm being done. So it's not a sign of negative behavior or obsessive behavior in itself.
So you think it's fair to criticize work not on the content of the research, but hey, like, oh, I think this is going to cause a lot of harm, or lead to evil or wrong policy choices.
Okay, no, well, not in itself. If that's the criticism, now I understand. So yeah. they're just saying what you're doing might lead, yeah. to that stuff, but they're, right. not saying it's wrong per se. No, yeah. okay, I was reversing it, that if somebody does something that's wrong, and you can point out why it's wrong, that you typically only go and put in the effort to actually criticize somebody if you think there are real negative costs associated with the wrong thing they said, because people are wrong all the time, but then I typically ignore it,
right.
unless it has some real consequences. But yeah. I understand, yeah, at this, yeah. point you're criticizing because you're saying this would, yeah. hurt people,
exactly.
not because it's wrong.
Right, okay. Which we've seen a lot, right? I mean, I spoke to somebody who does work on climate science, and some of the work that they were doing pointed in a direction that most climate science advocates would not have liked. And I think the criticism they got was, oh, the, you know, right wing media will take this up and claim that climate science is not a problem. So I think you face issues in a lot of cases in this way where people will sort of assume that it will be used by bad actors.
Yeah, it's interesting because sometimes I feel that here there are gradients. So it's super clear that it's correct, but it just has some potential to be misused, okay? But very often there's something debatable about it or the nuance could be different, right? So I think as you describe it, I think it's sort of problematic. But very often I also see people say things and they overclaim. And then you think, well, you know, you're overclaiming and that can lead to negative things or you're not highlighting other aspects. So the lack of nuance can make that there are negative things. And there I feel it's a little bit more acceptable to do it. So it's such a, you know, nuanced kind of thing. Like, is it okay or not?
Yeah, that's very fair. If you've, and that's one of, I mean, so going back to growth mindset, I mean, that is one of the criticism of the theory and the whole sort of subfield that it's, they have overclaimed so much and now you have school districts and people just adopting these, you know, interventions and these policies and implementing them when they should instead be focusing on, right? So there's an opportunity cost, right? That you should instead be focusing on more important things. And that is in some way a kind of harm, right? That if kids are instead of learning to read and write well or just being told that they should believe in themselves or something, then it's bad, which is a fair criticism, right? There was a lot of overclaiming in that area. Yeah.
And that's why these points where there's sort of criticism and people are unhappy about the criticism, they will still happen because they're just two different viewpoints on the thing. Right. If you weigh the potential costs more or, you know, or less, then you think the criticism is warranted or not. So I think often these cases are actually a little bit in the gray, whether it's okay or not. I mean, in the paper, they discuss clearly, the extreme versions where it's wrong. But in real life, we're often a little bit more in the messy area where you're like, well, yeah, from this viewpoint, okay, yeah, it might be fair to target this person for 3 years. Okay. But from this viewpoint, it's also very bad.
Yeah.
Both of them are just true, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. It kind of depends on the context. Then there's calls to suspend, censor, retract the work, and suspend and censor or retract the speaker. This is an interesting one that we've also seen a lot more in the past couple of years. This idea that we should, you know, retract work that some of it, which also like we don't agree with what policy choices it might lead to instead of the actual work. And censoring speakers or censoring their work. I think that's quite troubling, actually.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting because actually, maybe I'm a bit old fashioned in that sense, even though I spend a lot of time on social media, but I really focused on the role of criticism in scientific literature and, you know, the old fashioned kind of.
Yeah.
But all of this is about the role of criticism, scientific criticism, but much more in the online sort of communication. And it's very interesting because indeed, like this censoring, that happens online. It is pretty rare. I don't know any cases of this happening in published papers, for example. So it seems like there's a new sort of or extra types of criticism or maybe just more severe criticism that we can see in the on social media or that happen more on social media, at least.
Right. Wait, are you saying that you don't see a lot of calls for retraction that are done formally or that paper, because papers do get retracted because of Twitter mobs.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But more, you know, not in the obsessive kind of way.
Right.
I think it's so difficult to retract and calling for a retraction, right? That's what they're saying, calling for a retraction. People don't call for a retraction. Like getting something retracted in the scientific literature is a ton of work and you have to have very good arguments for it.
Yeah.
But this problem that's discussed is more that people just call for, hey, we should retract this, and without maybe too much evidence, or even what we've also often seen is, but if we retract this paper for the reasons you say, we should retract many other papers for the same logic, and we don't. So what makes this one special?
Right.
Which is what you can't get away with in the formal channels, because somebody will just point out, like, but this is illogical. If we do it here for this reason, we have to do it all the time,
right?
And we don't.
Yeah. And this kind of selective, and that probably feels more like an ad hominem attack, right? That we're being attacked for our work versus somebody else for doing the same thing. Or sometimes it's because people agree with,
Good point. Like, but what is the distinction then? Because it's not like a formal basis anymore. So definitely there's something mixed in.
Right.
Interesting.
Or it might just be visibility, right? All those others, like if you publish something which other work also shares certain features, but it's just not as visible, didn't get as much traction.
That's also
so
true.
It's just more visible and people want to attack. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's go through the rest of them. There's a lot of them, actually. But all, like I said, a lot of them that are behaviors, very, like I said, in this sort of social media, Twitterverse type vein. Mm-hmm. So guilt by association, claiming that since some nefarious groups enjoy the work must be incorrect. And it's interesting, you see that in another one of the sub-disciplines that I'm tangentially related to is intelligence, like research on intelligence. And there you definitely see this happening quite a bit of guilt by association, thinking that anybody who must be interested in studying intelligence must be a eugenicist. Or so I think that can be quite... harmful to, I think, the study of intelligence, which I think is quite important. Yeah.
But it's so interesting because all these behaviors, indeed, there was not really a lot of place for this in the scientific literature, I feel.
Yeah.
This is really on online criticism.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Really different beast.
Yeah. So let's go through them so then we can focus on the more important stuff. But then reputational tarnishing of individuals and their associates. So distortion or misrepresentation of conflicts. Speculation regarding true motives and funders, large gains in followers on social media, gained specifically through attacks, which I thought was very
interesting.
So people who gain a lot of attention just from attacking others, finding and positing sensitive personal information like home address or annual salary about the target. So that's like doxing.
Yeah, I bet.
So they mentioned that Nature surveyed 321 scientists during the COVID-19 pandemic and found that more than two-thirds faced negative experiences, especially following media appearances. The majority witnessed obsessive attempts to damage their credibility. One out of seven received even death threats, and six scientists were physically attacked. Professional complaints were sometimes filed against scientists. And this is so interesting because on one hand, if you want to work in some area which is important, you will probably get attention. But now it can lead to, right, back in the day, I mean, nobody who, unless they were reading your papers, you were writing for a very selective audience. But now things get filtered into social media, into popular press so often that, you might just get criticisms and some of this obsessive versions of it from Joe Schmo, from anywhere.
No, and this was an issue in the Netherlands maybe a year or 2 years ago as well. There was really like a lot of sort of concern among scientists. And I think the Royal Academy for Science actually wrote a statement about it or a report or something. There was some research like how many scientists are basically being attacked like this. And it happened quite a lot. And it is really sort of a threat for a healthy science. People are trying to basically use power.
Right.
To prevent scientists from doing their job, which is problematic.
Yeah. And conversations that should happen within the scientific community, right? I mean, especially if you had something like COVID-19 where we didn't know much at that time. And on one hand, you're like, yes, there's a need for information to get out. But on the other hand, right? I mean, good science is a little bit slower. So you need a lot of internal criticism and back and forth before you can be sure about what's going on. And once that starts happening in the public sphere, I mean, it becomes a lot more contentious. And I think not as you want healthy disagreement, not the sort of unhealthy kind that happens through social media. But then on to the healthy criticism.
Exactly. Because that might be more important, because if we acknowledge that, criticism is important, then how do we do it well? Apparently, I'm not supposed to gain a lot of followers by criticizing usually. Too bad. Damn it. That's the only way I get them. But okay, what are we supposed to do it well? They don't say it in the paper.
Oh, no, they don't. Oh, I thought you were just asking me.
I thought, okay, so how do we do? Well, I thought you were going to, similarly read. It's interesting. It's always easier to point out the wrong way to do it than the right way to do it.
I think the point of the paper was simply to say, hey, this is a thing. They do mention that insofar as disputes appear or pertain to journal articles, editors should actually take some responsibility to sort of commission a single back and forth. Editors could actually invite, like, let's say somebody wrote some kind of criticism on Twitter, which seems to have some merit. They could invite bloggers or tweeters to write a commentary and have it, like, formally somewhere
they probably don't feel that's so important to do because they don't want to get published.
Yeah.
But even if they would, I actually have a bit of a problem with organizing scientific criticism like this.
Really?
Because, yeah, because I've written commentaries and in a way, they are actually the least productive way of resolving a criticism that I know of.
Hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, one side writes their thing.
Yeah.
Very often, actually, these criticisms, in my experience, undergo minimal peer review because the problem is a little bit, if you let the other side peer review it, they're going to say, no, no, it's bad, it's bad. So editors are sort of like, you know, sometimes they'll read it or sometimes they'll even say, look, I'll read it. It looks kind of fine to me. Mm-hmm. You know, there are no insults. You seem to make some points. Mm-hmm. Then they let the other side respond and then you have this back and forth, but there's no real engagement.
Mm-hmm.
That's my problem with criticisms or comments on each other's work. There's no engagement.
Yeah.
You just try to make a couple of points. Word limits are small. And in the end, nobody is really much the wiser.
Right.
So we do have criticism. So, I mean, I understand their suggestion. Hey, let's have criticisms published. It's probably better than, you know,
nothing.
Having them somewhere. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, or having them on Twitter. Yeah.
But I really feel that this is not the way it should work. And I'm working on a paper now, just to give you, because I really, you know, I thought a lot about ways to do a bit more productive criticism, for example, right? We've done this project on red teams, for example, where you make criticism part of the whole research process. So you have a team of critics, they criticize every step of the way. But then you're part of the same team in the end, right? And it happens before you submit it for publication.
Right.
You're not fighting over getting published.
Yeah.
You're having this criticism about how you best will do the study. And that's a much nicer place to have the criticism.
I agree.
But in another paper, I wanted to criticize a thing in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
It's about type M and type S errors. And type M errors are basically a statement about inflated effect size estimates after you select for significance. So you might say, but Daniel, that's not an error, is it? It's an inflation. And I would say, yes, that's actually one of my criticisms. But anyway, okay. And a type S error is a name for an error in the opposite direction. So you say it's significant and you correctly reject the null hypothesis, but the effect is in the opposite direction.
Interesting.
Yeah, which can happen, you know, statistically. It's interesting to think about statistically. But anyway, you know, there are some issues I have with this. Now, and I spent some time in Padova with very lovely people there. And actually, the people there have written a paper on using type M and type S errors. Ironically, the first time I interacted with some of these people, I was basically their reviewer too on a paper years ago, before I met them, before I came.
Oh, and, interesting.
I mean, okay. So I was writing this and then I thought, yeah, you know, I don't want to have this back and forth or just write a commentary criticizing it. I also think that if you have a criticism, you might, I don't know, exaggerate a little bit or you might not be so nuanced as you can be if you are just, you know, attacking a viewpoint. So people in Padova have written this paper about this, just to sort of, you know, expanding on earlier work.
Yeah.
The original work is by Andrew Gelman and colleagues, Francis Teuerlings, for example, and Carlin. Some people wrote about it. But these people in Padova also wrote about it. And so, but I know them very well. And they're friends. And I think that's very nice because now you have people who have a difference in opinion. But you get along very well.
Right.
So you have really, let's say, good faith, basically, to begin with.
Yeah.
And you have motivation to listen to each other and to engage. So we had a meeting and the other person, Gianmarco Altoe, went into this meeting, I think thinking, okay, can we work together on this? Because I basically invited him like, hey, do you want to become a co-author on this paper? Because then internally we can, you know, we have the criticism internally.
It's like an adversarial collaboration.
Yeah, exactly. But not empirically, but more, based on arguments and for a statistical thing. And he went into the meeting thinking, maybe I should just write a commentary on it. But in the end, we discussed it quite extensively. And in the end, he's like, no, I think we can co-author something
nice.
And that made me very happy because I think it will just be much better, right?
Yeah.
Than having a commentary and back and forth because then, you don't resolve it. So actually, I would recommend this, like not write commentaries, force two people to spend some time together, really discussing it with each other.
Lock them in a room. Yeah.
But the weird thing is I have written many commentaries and I've never talked to these people.
Right.
you only communicate through a commentary. It's just weird. Yeah. You wouldn't do this in real life. Like, hey, we have a disagreement. Let's send each other a letter that we know the other side can't really change anything about. And then you can write one letter back and that's it.
Yeah.
That's just such a weird way to resolve a disagreement.
That is. We should have a conference. This should be, you know, the conference of criticism, where we just all come together. People who disagree on topics, they just, you know, you just assign everybody a little cubicle or a little table. You sit there and you just chat about it.
I would totally attend this. Like, I just want to see other people who have had discussions. I just want to see them. And then also sessions last 8 hours. You just sit there and you just talk.
And there's alcohol. Yeah.
There's alcohol. There's good food. You know, there's a break every now and then. And no, exactly. That's the way you should do it,
that
I think. Great.
Yeah.
The conference of criticism, and you have two sides and they just sit there and they just talk it through. And then
we've talked about this, right? In the consensus, where it's like you don't leave until the white smoke comes out.
When they select a new priest, they have to get together, and when they agree, and you don't let them go before they agree. Now here, maybe they can
don't have to agree, but at least you have to, you know, both be like, you should be able to state my argument really well, and I should be able to, right? And we can acknowledge like where we disagree and which points, and establish those fundamentals.
I think it would be much more beneficial than what we do now, because then the first 30 minutes will be quite fierce from both sides and lack some nuance. Mm-hmm. And then after like an hour, people are like, no, okay, this is the third time you point out that I'm being a bit too extreme in my viewpoint, or not representing your viewpoint well enough. Okay, I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. And then after 3 hours, you know, they'll just be half drunk, shoulder to shoulder, you know, like, oh, you're such a good guy. Yeah. I'm so glad that we did this. You know, I think that's going to happen, in my prediction. Right.
That sounds great. And I think just willing to engage in a conversation like that would automatically establish that at least you're trying to do it in good faith, because I think a lot of people who are not doing it in good faith would not even agree to something like this, right?
And it's interesting, because this interaction, so let's go a little bit away from social media and back to philosophers of science, bit more musty, but you know, but they have always said that this role, this criticism, is just so important to have reliable scientific knowledge, to get closer to the truth. So even among ourselves, and not fighting back and forth, but real criticism, resolving the criticism, seeing who's right, that this is just an essential part of doing good science. So I don't know why we don't really have it in a very nice setup, right? I think these commentaries are definitely not good enough most of the time. And beyond commentaries, people, it's very easy to just ignore some viewpoints of people altogether. Now, maybe many people feel like, hey, my view was so original, I'm being ignored. But nevertheless, I mean, I definitely think sometimes people are being ignored. And that also doesn't help, of course. So, maybe I'll read a little bit of Popper about this, because Popper has this viewpoint which is called critical rationalism. That's basically his philosophy on science for a large extent. So I'll read a little bit, because it's a bit long, but I think it nicely summarizes his main point. He says, the central problem of epistemology has always been and still is the problem of the growth of knowledge. And the growth of knowledge can be studied best by studying the growth of scientific knowledge. I do not think that the study of the growth of knowledge can be replaced by the study of linguistic usages or of language systems. He's criticizing positivists here. And yet, I'm quite ready to admit that there is a method which might be described as the one method of philosophy, but it is not characteristic of philosophy alone. It is rather the one method of all rational discussion. And therefore, of the natural sciences, as well as of philosophy. And then he goes on. He says, the method I have in mind is that of stating one's problem clearly and of examining its various proposed solutions critically. I have italicized the words rational discussion and critically in order to stress that I equate the rational attitude and the critical attitude. The point is, whenever we propose a solution to a problem, we ought to try as hard as we can to overthrow our solution, rather to defend it. Now this, of course, his falsification approach, but now the next sentence I think is nice. Last one. Few of us, unfortunately, practice this precept. But other people fortunately, will supply the criticism for us if we fail to supply it ourselves.
Nice.
So he is basically saying, if you want to have scientific progress, you have to be critical. We often fail.
Yeah.
But luckily, fortunately, if we fail, other people will do it for us. Isn't it great, Rindy? We should just be so grateful for everybody criticizing us, because this is what makes science what it is.
This is going off on a tangent, but how many papers do you think this is true of? Or like how much research? Because I'm not sure people are in like self-critical enough, but also most research doesn't get any attention.
Most people get no criticism at all. I mean, at least not publicly, right? People are not getting criticized. It's not that the criticism doesn't exist. And because people are afraid to give criticism.
Yeah.
Now, this is one of the reasons why peer review is anonymous, right?
Yeah.
So peer review is actually, according to many people, the place where scientists are supposed to criticize each other. This makes it so weird that often we don't even see the reviews, so we don't really know what's going on. So it would say open review, not signed review. Your name doesn't have to be there, but, you know, open reviews would be nice. But also, I found a nice quote by the founders of PubPeer. Do you know PubPeer?
I've heard of it. Yeah, it's where you can solicit peer review from just anybody. Just sort of open?
No. Okay, that's something else. That what you describe is peer community
Right.
Okay. It also has a peer. But PubPeer is basically an online platform where all papers with a DOI, I think you can just go there and you can say, I want to post a comment on a paper. And it can be a positive comment. You can say, what a lovely piece of work, but you will maybe not be surprised, because you can also anonymously post there. You will not be surprised that this is the place where many people are critical about paper, where they voice criticisms. And so the founders actually say, and one of them was a tenured professor at this time, he says that even a senior scientist very rarely, myself included, wants to take the risk of criticizing fellow scientists under their own names. Yeah. And I think this is true. Many people are like, well, really? I'm not going to say it out loud. I think this is true. Yes.
Why? Yeah. Like, why do you think that is?
Because people just will find you a negative person. They will not be Popperian about it. They will not say, oh, thank you so much for criticizing my work. This is how science grows. They will be like, you are attacking me, my work. You're being annoying. It's much nicer. Let's be true. If you write something and everybody just agrees, that's much nicer. It's much less work. But no, now you have to defend against critics somewhere. I mean, that's just annoying. You know, it takes up a lot of time. Other people might read the critics and agree with them. So it's just negative for yourself, right? I'm not talking about science, but for you, it's just not nice.
Well, yeah, for you, it's not nice, but I mean, it's difficult to deal with it. But I don't know, Daniel, science is supposed to be difficult. It's not supposed to be easy and fun.
Wait, they didn't say that anywhere. I didn't sign a piece of paper accepting this. What are you telling me now?
But no, this is, there's so many times often where I wish that ego did not play as big of a role in science as it does, right? It affects so many of like the people going out after incentives, the sort of awards and all this pomp and, you know, stuff that we do. And even like with criticism, right? People feeling attacked if their ideas are being criticized. I think that's not great in the overall, program. But you also made, I think, in a previous podcast, you made the really good point of, but then there would also be fewer incentives to do science, right?
Fewer incentives?
If you're not getting any kind of recognition or personal, you're not, it's not sort of a personal achievement that is motivating you, then there's just less motivation for people, which is also kind of a valid point. But at the same time, it's... people, you know, get so butthurt and you have these fragile egos and I don't get it. So there's also a nice paper by Lakatosh, where I think he's actually trying to explain Popper's views and what he calls sort of naive Popper and Popper 1 and Popper 2.
To which Popper once replied, "There are no multiple versions of me. You know, there's just one of me." But okay, yeah, go on.
It's called Criticism and the Methodology of Scientific Research Programs. Mm-hmm. And there he says, "The first stage of any serious criticism of a scientific theory is to reconstruct its deductive structure." And I think what's really interesting is that in some cases, the deductive structure is not even laid out that explicitly by the original researcher. So it was very fascinating to hear him say that, oh, in some ways, when you're criticizing a work, you are actually explaining the deductive structure of the theory. And I do think that it's incumbent upon you, if you are trying to criticize some work, to really be as explicit as you can in laying out what the theory is before you go criticizing. And I do think that, don't you think that in that case, people are a lot less likely to take it personally? And maybe I'm wrong there, but I think that if somebody said, "Oh, Smriti, that's a stupid argument, you're not making any sense," it's so easy to take that personally, whereas somebody said, "Okay, here's what you said. Here's the logical structure of your argument. I have a problem with premise 3 because it doesn't follow from, right? Like, or this is why where the logic breaks down." Okay, you know, that I would be a lot less likely to take personally because now you've actually done your homework and made it very explicit where I was wrong, right? And I think it's so much easier to take things personally when the argument against, like the criticism against your argument, is not detailed enough. And that is more work, I think, in some ways for the person doing the criticism. But, you know, hey, you do have a lot. The burden of proof is on you, right? So I think it's fair to say that people who are criticizing should do more of the legwork instead of just saying, "Oh, this is stupid."
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, lovely. And this book by Lakatosh is really great, but it's really a good book. I have another approach where people can maybe accept criticism a little bit more readily, and that is by acknowledging that there's diverse viewpoints, like different ways of looking at something.
Different ways of knowing, as Cole, sorry.
Maybe. I mean, so this is work by Helen Longino, and there I think she is sometimes a little bit more in this direction. Yeah, it could be interpreted in this direction, right. Definitely. Let me give you a quote. You can determine what you think. But Helen Longino writes, "Only if the products of inquiry are understood to be formed by the kind of critical discussion that is possible among a plurality of individuals about a commonly accessible phenomenon, can we see how they count as knowledge rather than opinion." So this is really a bit, you know, she, unlike Popper is basically, we have critical discussion, but we have it about the facts. So we're about to challenge tests and stuff, right? And she's really a little bit taking it away from data. So maybe, you know, know, as maybe we are not too fan of it here. Okay, maybe. But nevertheless, I think that this diversity of opinion, maybe not in how to evaluate evidence, but maybe in things people have missed, you know, let's just say possible confounds or also viewpoints, or maybe it doesn't generalize to these contexts or stuff like this. I do believe quite strongly, actually, that you can only know so much by yourself.
Yeah.
And that if you're in a group of people, that you'll see different viewpoints or they'll highlight cases or boundary conditions or whatever, you know. So I think that would also help if people... It's not so much an individual game. Again, it's more a collective discussion. You're like, here's my viewpoint and here. And maybe there's still, you know, disagreement. But I've often had actually the best criticism on my viewpoints comes from people who are actually very close to what I do and who I think would agree. But then they show a different viewpoint. Or sometimes in this podcast, we have the same, right? Where you point out something and I'm like, oh, this is a perspective.
Right.
That I had not considered before. But from this perspective, I guess you have a point. That happens sometimes, also when we talk. And I think, so that is also nice.
Right.
A nice way to get criticism, saying, look, it's not that your point is not formally correct. Mm-hmm. That's basically what you say. But there's a different perspective to look at this. And from this perspective, it also makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's another way to be a bit more open to, not being wrong per se, but being only... partially right, you know? Yes. I think that's fine.
And this is interesting. So in the same paper that I just mentioned, Lakatos' paper, he says Popper 2 concentrates on growth and not on refutation. Which I think is an interesting perspective of what you're saying, right? It's not that I'm trying to disagree with you or disagree, but we're trying to come to at least an understanding of, oh yeah, it's a different perspective. And from this perspective, it could also be okay. And sometimes we just might have different priorities and what we think is important, right? And it could lead us to have different interpretations or different views on things.
Yeah.
And I think the goal should be to, improve understanding and not just criticize, oh, you're wrong or you're wrong.
Yeah.
So I think that's, that's good. And I think here the conference of criticism would be great, right? Because I think it's so
it's so much.
I mean, especially on text and especially when you have this like really short form communication, it's so easy to totally misinterpret what somebody's saying. Mm-hmm. So easy to not get your points across clearly. Much harder to do that in person if you're just having a conversation one, because you could just ask like, hey, what did you mean by that? And right, like it's so much easier for these like subtleties and difference of interpretations or opinions to come out.
And in person it doesn't work out like this. So if you have a discussion in person, in my experience, it's just really different. It's really different. And so we should do it more. I'm a big fan of it. I often say, sometimes I say it explicitly, sometimes I think it, but also on Twitter, for example, you know, sometimes I say, look, if we would have like 4 hours and a beer, we would agree on 95% here. Yeah. But because of this medium, we're basically thinking we're on opposite sides of an argument. It also doesn't help make criticism more appreciated. I think this conference, that would make criticism something you're like, oh, this is actually a good thing and a nice thing and a positive thing. And I mean, I also had one last quote maybe from Lao Dong, also a philosopher of science, who's criticizing both Popper and Kuhn in his book.
Nice.
So it's kind of nice. So he's criticizing and he knows he's being very critical, but he writes, if the book is persistently critical of some of their ideas, it is because healthy disagreement, unlike imitation, is the deepest sign of an abiding admiration. Look, I mean, that's just nice, right? Healthy disagreement is a sign of admiration. I think it's a positive, more positive viewpoint.
That is a very, very nice viewpoint. And I actually quite agree, especially when you're, tell me if this ever happened to you, where you saw somebody that was like a much more well, like established researcher, right? Like a senior person. And sometimes they will criticize somebody's work in a way you know that they will not criticize your work because you're a young student. And to, like, I remember like Mark Wilson, who's one of my advisors. And I remember once we had, we were reading a paper, discussing a paper by Denny Borsboom. And he, at one point, he just said, at this point, he is just wrong. Like, he is just wrong. And I was like, oh, like, that's, you know, to be able to directly criticize, I was like, oh, I wish he would say that about anything I do, you know, to be bad. Where he's like, no, here you are just wrong. Because I do, like, and maybe I'm just weird that way, but I'm like, it does show a sign of respect, right? That you're like, you're treating somebody like an equal and saying, no, like, here you are just wrong. You're just incorrect.
I think it's so nice. No, it is a sign. In a way, it's a sign of admiration. Yeah. I mean, there's some stuff that goes in front of it, right? So first of all, engaging. The worst thing you can actually is just ignoring people.
True.
Exactly. So the moment that you engage, it's already a sign of this matters.
Right.
Because my time on the world, my time on earth is limited. And I'm choosing to engage some of the time. So it means that you think somebody's talking about something that matters.
Yeah.
You might not agree on how they talk about it, but at least they picked something that's important. And indeed, then, if you have a real point of disagreement, it can actually be a good sign of admiration, also because it requires a very good understanding of the point of the other people to then articulate why you think they disagree.
It's wrong,
So you really invested
and taking it seriously, right? I mean, sometimes you see trolls on Twitter, you're not going to engage with it. You're not going to take their criticism seriously. Exactly, right? So if you're criticizing something, you're both engaged and understand it and also taking it seriously, worthy of criticism, right?
And I wonder how many senior scientists feel admired the moment they get criticism. But maybe to end, I wanted to talk not about the senior scientists, but about the junior scientists getting criticism. I have the feeling we do not educate people how to deal with criticism, which is inevitable.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I knew we were going to talk about that, but I also thought at this moment you were going to say that young people are also scared of criticizing more senior academics, which I actually think is probably true and I wish weren't the case, but yeah.
Maybe that's, I mean, maybe I'm getting too old to think about this. Or maybe I was always, I have to say that I was maybe not so much like...
Really?
Yeah, I didn't have this problem myself. I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think I do either, interestingly.
No, but I understand. It definitely happens. It definitely happens. I mean, a lot of the time I really have to work quite hard for people to, like, for for example, there's like, I'm co-authoring something with like relatively new PhD students and with a visitor in the lab, but I'm writing something. It's, so this is the first time I think I am the principal author and they are co-authors. Often it's the other way around. But this is sort of my paper. I wrote most of it, but I'm like, hey, please help me out because I need some people to, you know, push back to some ideas or make it better. But here I feel I really have to train them a little bit to be critical. So the person who's visiting went through the part of the text that they picked to work on. And it's so kind. It's so nice. I mean, they're keeping so much of my stuff there. So I said, look, I really appreciate it if people just tear it down. For
but this
example,
is not helpful. Really this is not helping improve it.
No,
I know.
No. And this is the polite first round. But sometimes you need to figure out what people like when you write together. Mm-hmm. That, you know, how far can you go? And I mean, I really need a lot of pushback, actually. Yeah. I benefit from fierce discussion and internal criticism.
Me too.
But yeah, that can be difficult. But I think the other thing maybe is just
dealing with criticism.
And in a couple of ways. So I've had this recently, junior people. First of all, somebody I gave feedback on their first writing. I think that's just because, you know, this is the first time, like the first time a PhD student sends something in that they have written. Now, you know that they spent a ton of time on this, like way more than the 17th thing they're going to send my way. Right. Then they're like, okay, yeah, here it is again. So they really tried. They want to make a good impression, but you have a ton of criticism on writing, structure, arguments, clarity, you name it, you know. It's just difficult to write well because, I mean, it took me forever, honestly, forever. It maybe people think I don't write well, but I mean, at least I'm kind of happy with what I do. But that took like 6 years or something before I felt comfortable, well after my PhD. So in the beginning, you're just not very good at it, of course. But here I would say again, if you get a lot of criticism on a paper, you know, it's really read throughout. You know, like every sentence has been changed or every other sentence. In my experience, it is actually a sign that you did a very good job. It's much more problematic if I have to say, well, these next 7 paragraphs, I don't know what you're doing here, but I'm not going to spend time, you know, going through it and giving you feedback on it because these 7 things just, I don't know what this is. No, if you get, you know, criticism. But there I had to explain, like, okay, so this is how it happens, you know. I had a sort of meta conversation on, okay, so you're gonna get this back, but before I give it back, like, this is going to be completely read, and that's a good thing. That's how it works. And the same with another former bachelor student who got their first reviews back on a paper. So I had to explain, like, okay, so this is how it's going to go, and some of them are going to be sensible and improve it, and some of them are not going to be so sensible, but you still have to engage with it. And, you know, so... training people really about how to deal with the fact that they will be criticized fairly or not fairly, both. I mean, I think that we don't do this anywhere, I feel. We just let them experience it and learn. And if they survive, then good for them. But
and do you think the responsibility is on the person getting the criticizee to sort of manage, you know, like, hey, I should be mindful of and how do I deal with criticism versus also teaching people how to give, right? Like, I'm sure not everybody gives criticism the way you are giving it, right? Where they're like, hey, let's have this conversation first and explain to them that this is, you know, a positive thing and I'm just trying to help you improve. Or even as a reviewer, I mean, sometimes you have people saying kind of nasty things in reviews, which are unwarranted, instead of sticking to, right? Like, we're like, is it both?
On
is
all
one
sides.
More? Yeah, okay.
It's such, no, but it's, if this is an essential thing about science, the critical aspect, the critical, then it should happen everywhere all the time. I mean, we should repeat it. So students should learn how to give criticism.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think we teach them how to give, them how to give criticism. True. I mean, we have some peer review assignments and sometimes they say stuff, but giving good criticism, I don't think we teach that. We just let them give criticism, I think. Yeah. Do you agree? I mean, do you remember a course or?
On how to give criticism?
Any training?
Mm-hmm. No, I've just always been very combative, so I never needed training on it.
You're a natural.
I'm a natural. but I mean, you know, again, in my cultures, you were definitely taught to sort of just be respectful, especially, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that just comes from just learning how to interact with people in an academic environment. You just always remain, you know, respectful. And it's just never taught. And I think there's some part of it where, right, like if somebody's saying something that I think it just isn't right, I am just so compelled to say something, even if it has social costs, you know, like, and I wish, I don't know what to call it, but this idea of like, right, like not being, and I do think people a lot of the times are just now afraid to speak up and criticize because, either people are, you know, higher up and they feel like there will be some negative consequences personally or professionally for them. But I'm like, no, but sometimes, like, right, the truth is kind of more important than you know, your professional outcomes. Maybe that's wrong. But I think so. Some idea of like, hey, you know, the truth is just sort of worth standing up for, even if that means sort of, standing up to people. Yeah.
Yeah. But having this as a discussion, I mean, discussing this with people, I don't think we do this at all, you know, or just educate people about this critical role that, essential role that criticism plays. So that's super important. And if you have a solid understanding of it, I don't know if it helps, but if you say, look, this is what we're trying to do with peer review. And the point is that, you know, we all write and we miss things. We have other people with other viewpoints and they tell us what they think. And sometimes you'll agree, sometimes not. But as a scientist, this is basically one of the core things in which we increase the quality of our work, like it or not. And I think many people will admit, despite all the criticism sometimes on peer review, like, I don't think there's a paper that I've written that hasn't improved after peer review.
Nice.
In other words, peer reviewers really help me write a little bit better paper. They also waste my time sometimes.
Because they're like, why aren't you running this study?
But most of the time, you know, most of the time. And this last thing is also reflecting on it. So I remember somewhere as a young researcher really reflecting on, okay, I am getting criticism now, quite harsh criticism or something. And then just reflecting like, okay, but you know, this is just part of what I signed up for. It's not even like... that I think this is important for science, because sometimes I felt like not all this criticism is correct, but this is the thing we're doing, you know? Not all the criticism you get is perfect, but on average, in the long run, it will improve science. And that conviction sort of helps you to, go through the better or the worse. And I also tell students, you know, sometimes I'll say something, I'll give you feedback, and then 2 weeks later, I might say the opposite thing. And then it's just bad stuff I'm saying, you know, not every criticism I give is good. So your goal is also to ignore my criticism sometimes and take the right things. And
you're right. I mean, that these discussions need to be had with graduate students, how to deal with criticism, when to also use your own judgment, right?
And
not just take criticism on face value. And stand up. And even, I mean, even in the review process, right, people will often say that if you really disagree, like, hey, this is going to make the paper worse, you should stand up to that and argue for not accepting that feedback or that criticism. We just need more constructive criticism and sort of people being okay with it both ways, right? Like how to give constructive criticism and also accept constructive criticism.
And in this conversation, it just makes me realize we don't offer a lot of space for it. We sort of say it should be constructive and stuff, but actually the formats we have and the way we organize it don't provide the best ground for having constructive criticism. So Yeah, super interesting to work on our first conference, criticism conference, where, you know, 8 hour long, you know, people watch chess games for like 6 hours. They will totally watch two people just, you know, discuss and criticize each other.
They could be podcasts, like long form podcasts. Everybody has like a little recorder in front of them. Yeah. I think that's reality great. Shows. We should put it together.
You know, we put them on a tropical island somewhere. It's just a reality show. 2 weeks of recordings. that's the next level after the conference.
Sounds great.
Nice.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nullius in Verba. Our theme song is Newton's Cradle by Grand Brothers. If you have any thoughts, feedback, or comments you'd like to share, you can reach us over email at nulliusinverbapod@gmail.com or our social media accounts at Mastodon or Twitter.
In this episode, we talked about the critical role of criticism in science, which should be fair and objective to be constructive. In the next episode, we will follow this thread and talk about the role of objectivity and disinterestedness in science. We hope you will join us.